Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Have accessed entry 210.MT0620, certificate number 7089, the Cheapside Horde.
We've talked about this before. You don't wear any adornment. No rings, no jewels. You've got a wedding ring.
The most minimal, just kind of boring white gold engagement or wedding ring, wedding band imaginable.
No little gold cross on a thin gold strand?
Nope. No pierced genitalia. Nothing. I can't remember. I don't think there's ever been a time in my life where I wore jewelry. I find, I was kind of worried that I would find this a wedding band to be kind of annoying. But you know,
it doesn't burn.
It's far from the most annoying part of being married. No, it's, you know, 20 years later, I don't even notice it. And I presumably that would be true if I...
You tell Mindy that?
Yeah, I don't even notice it in social situations. No, presumably that would be true of, you know, I could get used to earrings or nose rings or whatever if I wanted, but I never have. I never see you in a necklace or anything.
No, I mean, over the years, I've tried to wear different things. I thought... You know, sometimes you see somebody with a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
With a bunch of bracelets and cool stuff hanging off of them. And you think like, oh, wow, that would be cool. Kind of like every once in a while. Like I was watching a Harry Potter movie with my daughter the other day. And Sirius Black, played by the great Gary Oldman, he's wearing a black velvet jacket with his shirt kind of hanging open and all these bangles, and I was like, why aren't I more like Sirius Black? You know, and I said to my daughter, like, if I stopped wearing pink Oxford cloth shirts and started dressing more like Sirius Black, like, do you think that would be a cool look on me? Would you be, you know, more impressed with your good old dad with his cool rings? And she was just, it's just one more opportunity to roll her eyes at me so hard that it actually feels like a punch.
But that's because kids don't want to imagine their parents changing or trying anything about their look. I think I
always feel like I should have been cooler. I never was as cool as I could have been, and jewels and stuff. I don't know. It's always felt like I wore a puka shell necklace for a long time because I was a dope. And
is that appropriation?
No, because it was from the 1970s when we all wore puka shell necklaces with shark's teeth on them. And it was just a thing that I carried over a long time past the point where, in Seattle grunge rock culture, like looking like a surfer wasn't really part of the look.
It just seems like it would take a lot of time
to wear stuff, to have jewels, to have a jewelry box.
Yeah. Like imagine how long it takes, like, Elton John to get ready, you know?
Oh boy.
Or just,
you know, starts the night before.
Right. Or, you know, whoever it is wearing a ton of bracelets or whatever.
Does Mindy wear jewelry?
Yes.
Do you buy her jewels as a component of your marriage?
Yeah. Usually just for a gift giving occasion, you know, as an anniversary present goes, you know, earrings seem marginally more romantic than,
a book,
a KitchenAid, or a or the new Elena Ferrante or something,
a cookbook,
exactly,
a vacuum cleaner. So without giving away too much, without making your home a target for burglars, like what are some of the gifts that you've gotten Mindy over the years? The amethyst.
Her tastes are not really too ostentatious. So, but you know, there, I assume there are people who just want to wow their partners with, you know, 5 and 6 figure strands of whatever. Here's a diamond bracelet. It's got 80 diamonds on it.
Well, you know, my sister is one of the people who likes big rings. And so she has these, you know, big stones, like kind of comically large stones to my eye. But she wears them with this kind of sort of, I don't know, the Southwest turquoise wearing High Plains women of Taos, New Mexico.
Sure. It's for her chi.
Yeah. And it all works. It all works. But it also feels like all that stuff feels like it makes it more difficult to operate machinery if you have to, like more difficult to make it through like a tight, if you had to get out through a culvert.
I do think that about Steven Tyler or whatever, like that guy's got to play the guitar.
He doesn't.
Do those bracelets ever get in the way?
Steven Tyler has never touched a guitar in his
life. Oh, he just sings.
He just plays the mic stand that's covered with scarves.
Right? Yeah. Well, I guess that explains it. You can wear unlimited jewelry if you don't have to pick up an instrument.
Exactly. Steven Tyler is just increasingly more and more just made of jewelry. And as he withers away inside, the scarves and jewelry.
Scarves are taking over.
Carry on the.
It's going to be like the end of a magic trick where you, at some point, somebody pulls something and it's just all scarves and he's not there at all.
Well, as you probably know, jewelry has a long and storied history in human life.
Is this,
right?
Is this the first sentence of a high school history paper? For thousands of years, people have had many different opinions and aspects of jewelry.
Right. Jewelry is good. Some of the stuff, it's some of the oldest stuff we find.
It's, right. It's often made of things that last.
And people's bones wither away, but the jewels live on. The jewels are the remains that we find.
Yeah. The guy withers away sometimes on the stage as we watch.
Right.
But the jewels are still, the skull rings are still there.
And they're a way that we, you know, they're one of the reasons that we rob graves even to this day, Ken. I mean, it's a big reason to dig up somebody to
Are you going
to
write a self-help book?
To see what the people that were sad about them dying threw in on top of them.
Don't flip houses. Just rob graves. Make your way to success through the 7 steps the John Roderick way.
But I think it's a major aspect of archaeology. You know, archaeologists themselves, those small, withered, little pinch-faced tweed people
with their little glasses, yeah, peering at you through their little glasses,
who care about stuff that's written on rocks. They're a small subset of the much more glamorous sort of grave robbing, like guild of people who are out there finding gold things.
Well, think how exciting it would be. I mean, archaeologists get excited about a little chipped bit of
pot,
ceramic, or yeah, clay.
Yeah.
Oh boy, I hope I can find another triangle of pot around here the same size, because maybe I can then put it together and know how big the pot was. And you know, if I was an archaeologist, I would just love to actually find something shiny and cool where people would want to look at it. You know, or even outside of context, the layperson is going to say, "You found that in the ground in Shropshire?"
Yeah, that and. I mean, gold and jewels, boy, they look so pretty, and
this is your take on precious metals and gems.
They're so pretty, and they tell such an articulate story about the wealthy and privileged of another time, which is kind of what we have always called history. Want.
Yeah, it makes the past seem glamorous, which it probably wasn't, but it shows us this very narrow aperture where it kind of was.
Yeah, my sister always objects when we travel when we travel together, because I want to go see the museums and the things, and she kind of dismisses it all as just like rich people's houses and rich people's stuff. Why would I want to go see rich people's stuff? And I'm like, well,
they do have nicer stuff.
Yeah. I mean, poor people didn't leave as many earrings behind. But we do have a a tendency, a bias to think of the past as being well, we look at it only through the lens of the rich people stuff that we find, right? Right? It's very hard to, and I think
that's who the art is about often.
Yeah, it's a recent development in trying to reconstruct a past from a people's history.
And I like that too when you see different kinds of kitchenware unearthed, or I like seeing children's toys. Yeah. We were in a exhibit of Roman era stuff unearthed outside Frankfurt earlier this summer, and you could see what the kids were playing with, their little carved ducks and men and yo-yos, dice and other kinds of games. Here's the board. We don't know what the rules were. that kind of stuff is fun in a way that you don't get from seeing grand palaces and gilded stuff.
What's interesting is that there are epochs, time periods where there's a lot of archaeological record in terms of like treasure found, what are described in Europe and in the UK in particular as hoards. And then there are periods that are underrepresented in archaeology. You know, goldsmithing kind of ebbs and flows. In the UK, or goldsmithing, silver hoarding, there are great periods, kind of like the whole like Anglo-Saxon period has a lot less archaeological record than some eras before and after, in the UK in particular. You know, one interesting thing about hordes of ancient, ancient wealth buried in the ground.
Buried treasure. What could be more fun?
Is that the invention and popularization of the metal detector has really changed how we approach these wonderful historical finds. Like the metal detector is a fairly new invention, and it's...
Is it 20th century? Yes, right?
Yes. It uses a kind of alternating, oscillating magnetic field, and you can buy them at Radio Shack. If Radio Shack still existed, you would be able to buy them at Radio Shack. But it becomes a popular subculture. It has become. You've seen metal detector men generally out in the wild, haven't you?
Yeah, it's kind of a punchline now, just because it just seems like a bored guy on a beach who eventually finds a quarter or nothing.
And they actually find a lot of stuff. In fact, just recently...
Oh, is that true?
Yeah, just in the last year, someone in Germany found the remains of a Roman military leader, like a big pile of gold filigree and stuff from his uniform, and a gilded chair that would have been his litter. Found it in the forest, just beep, beep, beeping out there with his metal detector. And instead of reporting it, he dug it up and tried to sell it at a pawn shop and got busted, because that's against the law in Germany now. If you find, just to any futurelings who are listening to this show, in one ear while they're listening to their metal detector in the other, you can't just dig it up and take it to a pawn shop. You should report it. When you find something
in their time, maybe they can.
Wonderful in the forest.
Like, imagine them digging up our non-fungible tokens.
I feel like futurelings, when they dig stuff up, it's all going to be like old non-operative iPhones. And I mean, what are they going to find?
Scraping germanium out of the back of an iPhone. Yeah. Trying to see it. Oh, this, I wonder if this Game Boy will boot up.
No, they'll just be throwing plastic bottles and banana peels into their flux capacitors and traveling through time. That's what the future holds.
There's not, I've read that, we've now, we had enough fossil fuels, et cetera, other resources in the earth to do this once,
right.
And then we used it all and we kind of screwed it up. So, whoever digs up this stuff now, you can probably piece together enough, metals to do metallurgical stuff, but you just don't have the power to become a civilization again. I'm sorry.
Is that right?
I'm sorry. Yeah. We already did that.
I feel like it's maybe the opposite, and this is one of the premises of my longstanding Supertrain futurism. We have condensed all of the oil and silver and germanium in landfills. We've brought them from all the disparate places of the world, and we've brought them, we've used them once, and then we've put them in a big pile, covered it with a thin layer of earth, and you can go back and excavate and then reprocess all that material. It's just there for the taking. It's like pulling up railroad rails and resmelting them, like the iron's there.
All mining will basically be
landfill mining.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they'll be like prospectors. They're like, what a rich load I found.
Yeah, look at this.
It's a locomotive.
An old washing machine and a couple of PCs, and look at the platinum I got out of these things. So hoards are as we've talked many times, the idea of archaeology, the idea of finding old things and trying to contextualize those things in their time and to draw conclusions about history from grave sites and from, you know, archaeological digs, that's a fairly recent thought technology. It didn't really exist prior to the mid-19th century in any appreciable way.
Before, if you found stuff, it was because you were a grave robber and you were going to keep it.
Or you were going to keep it, you were going to melt it down, presumably, as fast as you could to make something else. Or you were using it to prove that the earth was only 3,000 years old. Or, you know, you were astonished that that dragons had left behind these enormous skeletons and it was God that was doing it in order to tease you and question your faith. It was really only in the late 19th century that there started to be even a sense that history was a story that could be told in relics, and that finding things in place in the ground was a thing that you should hold in certain, you know, like it, not only reverentially, but that you needed to very carefully excavate a thing in order to see.
Right. Anybody but a scholar would mess it up.
Right. Would mess it up.
You would need the context.
It wasn't just it wasn't just that you pulled a bunch of coins out of the ground, washed them off, and then stacked them neatly. It was, you know, how you found them told as much of the story as the coins.
I wonder if, you know, we kind of have there's this, what seems to be just this innate childlike wonder at the idea of finding something in the ground, buried treasure.
Right.
But I wonder if that's not really that natural to us at all. It's just been instilled by kind of an accident of literature that there were, that was a certain kind of boy's adventure story in a certain period, and it created a culture of, let's go see what the ground hides. I guess it could be innate just based on a hunter-gatherer evolutionary mind that you want to, you know, try to pull valuable things out of the soil. But
yeah, if you think about the novel Treasure Island, it dates from 1882.
Yeah, all those tropes of, you know, pirates drawing maps, those never existed. Pirates would not bury their treasure on a beach and take off. That's a very unusual strategy if you're a pirate. You need that capital.
But finding gold in the plowed fields of England was, or silver, was not entirely uncommon.
That could happen, right? A farmer would just find Roman stuff while plowing.
But one of the most famous hoards, really in the world, was not found in a farmer's field. It was, in fact, found in the very heart of London. And that's not surprising. London is a city that goes back to Roman times. And the ground in the city of London is rife with pottery shards and evidence of habitation dating back millennia. But in 1912, a very different kind of hoard was discovered directly in the center of the city of London.
The city of London, if it's not remembered in your time, is not what we think of as London. It's a very small little financial center, you know, maybe a radius of a few blocks wide. The other parts of what you think of as London are actually, you know, officially the city of Westminster or whatever, a tiny urban core is officially the capital C city of London.
Right. And a city of London that would have been really a walled compound until,
yeah,
well, even until modern times. But we're talking about the area basically in earshot of the bells of the Church of St. Mary LeBow.
Which is what makes you a Cockney. LeBow.
Which is it?
I think it's LeBow.
LeBow. St. Mary LeBow. That's right. It's the traditional area that if you're born where you can hear the sound of the bells, then you're a Cockney Englishman. And this is back when, this dates to not that long ago, but when there were still residential neighborhoods in this area, less and less so all the time.
It's funny to think there would be an accent that would be different than the accent, you know, 10 blocks away or wherever the bell noise stops.
In fact, they're saying now that Cockney is morphing into a more diverse language because this area of London has, you know, more and more people from around the world.
It's an immigrant neighborhood.
It's an immigrant neighborhood, but it does still have a lot of the inflection of Cockney, and it's kind of becoming a new dialect. It's fairly exciting, the immigrant dialect of the earshot of St. Mary LeBow.
So, but this would just be a stone's throw from like St. Paul's Cathedral.
Right. Just right across the street, in fact. And it's an area that's known as Cheapside, which dates back to, it was always the kind of market street of old London, right near St. Paul's, but also, you know, this was the area of all the old guilds of London tradesmen and you know, the fishmongers.
So they'd be different kind of merchants but also craftsmen and stuff.
It comes from the Latin "cep," which means marketplace. And
is that where our word "cheap" for a good marketplace steal comes from?
Yeah, cheap comes from a kind of like, you know, it became the phrase was "godchep," which meant like, yeah, that was a good, you know, you made a good deal. It was a good market.
A good buy. Like bon marché.
And eventually it became cheap, meaning market, and then cheap in our current sense. But the neighborhood was, you know, there was West Cheap.
But there's no imputation about the character of the neighborhood by calling it Cheapside then.
No.
It just means it's a market neighborhood.
It wasn't cheap like Chintzy. That only happened in recent times. It was just a market. But this region, you know, was a region of craftspeople and goldsmiths all the way back to, you know, to the dawn of London. And in 1912, a lot of it was destroyed during the Blitz.
Oh.
And it was destroyed during the Great Fire of London before that. So, you know, the area there in the ground was kind of rich with rubble. But in 1912, so prior to the Blitz, 1912, it was a period of great rebuilding in the center of London, you know, from the end of Victoria to the right before World War II. This was an area a time period where London was experiencing like dramatic growth and big new buildings were being built. Old kind of shoddy neighborhoods were being torn down and replaced with modern buildings in the style of the time, right? The Art Deco era. And in the process of tearing down some of the old shops in Cheapside and building new structures, a foundation was unearthed by a group of workmen in 1912. And in the basement of this building, the foundation predated the building they were tearing down by many centuries.
Okay.
They discovered a big sort of agglomerated ball of mud and shiny bits.
Ooh, so it's not in a chest or anything.
No, it was
that you have to pry open.
It had been in a chest, and so it was chest shaped.
Oh, the chest didn't last.
The chest.
Do pirates
was gone.
Know this? Burying all their chests in the sand. Do they know the chest is just not going to make it?
Usually, stuff that was buried in a chest comes out of the ground as a fused lump.
Chest is just wood. It's gonna rot away.
There are some hoards that have been discovered where it was very clear, you know, that you bring the clump out and you can X-ray it and actually see where the coins were in bags inside of a box.
And the bags are gone.
The box is gone, but you still see the shape of the coins in bags. And until very recently, you would pull the stuff out and wash it because you're looking for the coins, not the story of the box. Nowadays, archaeologists want the whole, you know, sure. They want
to
look at the whole.
This is their one chance to get the story of the box.
Right, get the clump. But at this point, it was a group of workmen. This was an era, you know, pre-excavating machinery. So most of these
just guys swinging,
yeah, pickaxes, and they
did they fight? Did they fight over it?
No, it was somewhat commonplace. I mean, probably part of the problem of excavating London with big excavators now is that all the dirt goes onto a barge and it gets dumped in the ocean, and there isn't anybody really sifting through it, but. But
oh, I never thought about that.
Yeah, and this is true everywhere that you know, in Athens, anytime you build a building, like all of that dirt, you only have one chance not to go through it with a claw.
Yeah.
And once you've gone through it with a claw, I'm sure this happens on construction sites all the time where somebody looks down in the hole and goes,
that was a Roman architecture.
Well, that, and I think in the United States, it's like, oh, this is a graveyard.
Right.
Do we stop construction forever, or do we?
Can we hush this up under dead of night?
Yeah. Do we quickly dig this hole and put everything in the ocean as fast as we can? I'm sure it happens all the time. And I mean, my next door neighbor at my old house worked as a guy making big sewer systems for the city. And at a certain point early on in our relationship, I said, hey, anything you find in a hole, will you just bring me, like, anytime you're digging a hole in downtown Seattle, will you bring me whatever you find that you don't want for yourself? And he was like, I find so much stuff. And so pretty soon, the fence between our property, he would just come over every day and put a new bottle of old Dr. Jones's medicamental bottle of goop. And I had this whole collection of stuff that every day he kind of, or not every day, but every week he'd have some other little bunch of stuff that he found.
Some of the stuff must have collector value. He just wasn't interested in tracking down.
No, I mean, it wasn't his scene. Yeah. And ultimately, like, I just liked it because it was beautiful. I didn't try to.
You're a magpie.
Yeah, I didn't try to start a separate marketplace.
You don't have an eBay shop.
But also, Seattle is a young town. Yeah. It's not like in Athens where every inch of the ground has probably got five things buried on top of each other.
We were in, where was this? Mines, just outside of Frankfurt. And there's one of the biggest tourist attractions in town is they were digging a big mall in the city center and came across this very unusual Roman, like pagan temple, of which there's like only one example. And so they did not cover it up. They just, in the basement of the mall, put in a free, here's the preserved temple. Come walk along the foundations of it. And it's just kind of eye-opening. That's what it's like to do construction in Europe. There's always going to be something old underneath you.
And what's interesting is that this is that right there is a solution to the problem that we've come up with right now. And it seems so much better to us than what we would have done 50 or 100 years ago, which is demolish it.
There's just going to be a Roman temple under the Benetton.
Right. Or 1,000 years ago where they would have taken all those bricks and made a new house out of them.
Yeah.
But I'm sure 100 years from now, people will look back at the incorporation of the temple into a mall as like an absolute desecration. That's one possible direction. It could also be that in the future, there is no veneration of the past. Everyone is living entirely in the present.
Or that it all just flattens so that to them, the Benetton and the Roman temple are of equal interest. So why wouldn't they be
right.
Chock-a-block?
At this moment in London, there was a man who kind of bridged the gap between a time when buried treasure was just thought of as treasure and buried treasure was regarded as archaeologically and culturally important.
Like a scholarly pursuit.
And he was a man by the name of Stony Jack, he was called Stony Jack.
There's no way his name was Stony Jack.
His real name was George Fabian Lawrence. And he was a kind of, you know, he was a local boy who got, who just had a transformative experience finding old flint tools in the dirt around his house and became intrigued by the storytelling nature, you know, the storytelling possibilities of things you dig up out of the ground.
Oh, he wasn't just a reseller? He actually... He knew historians or professors or something?
He was a person that was interested in the artifacts, but more than as things that he could sell and resell. He was able to look at things and kind of have that vision of the past that an old thing might suggest. And he was a reseller. I mean, he was a trader in ancient artifacts.
I see. So he would line up buyers and do well off this.
But. Yeah, but he was one of the first people to make the connection between, because our archaeologists can't find everything, right? Most of the stuff that we find, it's not found. It's the rare hoard that's actually found as a component of an archaeological dig. Most stuff is found by farmers and by people, you know, like wandering around catching frogs in a stream.
That would be the start of the dig, not part of it.
And often, and until very recently, and even now, the stuff is dug up by the excited person, not by most people don't see a glint of gold in a stream bed and go, I should call an authority, right? I mean, if you were out in the woods tromping around and you looked down and saw gold coins sticking out of the ground, would you not dig them up yourself? Would you wait? Would you get on the phone and call the Burke Museum?
I'd be tempted. I mean, I don't even know what the legality is. It's different in different jurisdictions.
It's different in different jurisdictions, and you know, often the experience of discovering the provenance of a hoard leads you places you might not expect, and sometimes you know it actually belongs to somebody.
Is hoard really the technical term? Because it sounds like a dragon thing.
No, it does. But hoard is the term of art for
if you find good stuff, it's a hoard.
Because there are a lot of, I mean, throughout history, people that had a bunch of valuables that were or a bunch of you know coins or gems or gilded knives when invaders were pounding down the gates of the compound, really the only thing you could do to keep your stuff safe was to dig a hole in the ground and cram it down there. And if it ended up that you were killed or never came back,
never made it back,
it just stayed there in the ground. That's the very nature of buried treasure.
Or if you forget where it is, like at the end of Fargo.
And there's some suggestion. So this group of pick wielding, you know, foundation digging laborers in 1912.
Cockney laborers
found these shiny baubles under the floor of this building they were excavating, and they already knew about Stony Jack because Stony Jack had made friends with all the laborers in this neighborhood. He was, by all accounts, a very personable guy, and he recognized that. As these structures were being unearthed, people were finding stuff right and left, and they were, you know, they were kind of showing up at the tavern with a pot or a bracelet or whatever they'd found in that day's excavations, and they were trading it for a pint of beer, and so Stony Jack just kind of inserted himself into that transaction in the neighborhood and made it known to everyone, hey, whatever you find in a hole, bring it to old Stony Jack, and I'll give you a fair price for it. And it's, you know, from a contemporary standpoint, it feels like he's an unethical operator, right?
Some kind of fence, right?
Yeah, he's in there fencing stuff. But really, this was still a time when a lot of this stuff would have just, you know, would have either been tossed away as just old pot shards, who cares about it, or would have found its way into a black market that was a kind of, you know, one that had no sense of the importance of these artifacts. And Stony Jack did. He had connections with he had connections with the British Museum. He had connections with the Guildhall Museum. You know, he was trying to identify the most important of these pieces and find homes for them in what was kind of a new sense of what a museum. The function of a national museum.
Right. It's kind of a Victorian invention.
So people started to bring, you know, these workmen. Oh, and Stony Jack was kind of well known as someone who gave you a fair price, and also would, if he ended up selling it for a lot more to a museum or to someone, he would kind of come back and say, here, I'm actually going to give you a little taste of the profit. Right. And he would always give you something. No matter what you brought, he would find a way to say like, oh, this is not really worth anything, but I'll give you the cost of a pint of beer or whatever, just to keep the goodwill flowing. But Stony Jack recognized that this big, that the stuff that was coming his way from these various workmen represented represented an important find, because the quality of the jewels and the great diversity of them and where they were found, it wasn't just a, you know, it was an actual stash of important and valuable works, and where they were found and how they were found was an important story. And so he went about buying up as much of it as he could from the workmen.
The workmen had kind of divvied it up?
Yeah, and they'd taken it and sold it here and there. Yeah. And he brought it back together, and he involved the what was the kind of at the time new Museum of London, and tried to collect all this stuff back together. And it was recognized that this was the foundation of what had been a goldsmith back, a goldsmithery in a neighborhood of jewelry smiths.
How old?
That in looking at the found items, it was pretty obvious that it had been buried right in the kind of Jacobean era, right prior to the English Civil War. So looking at 1640s.
Okay.
Because there was a particular cameo that commemorated the ennoblement of the Viscount, the first Viscount Stafford, and that happened in 1640.
Oh, so you can date it by the people had little commemorative, what do you call these? Commemorative coins or whatever?
Yeah, but this was actually like a little, that would have been a kind of a singular.
Did it belong to one of the people involved?
Yeah, I think it would have been, you know, it would have been an intaglio that
it was in the family.
In the family, right. And the English Civil War story made sense, both because a lot of who would have been the jeweler class would have been conscripted into the war. The city of London was an anti-royalist sort of region, so much so that
that was like a Cromwell district.
It was, and so a lot of the a surprising number of people went off to fight in the war, and the kind of later thought about this, the discovery of this hoard, which became known as the Cheapside hoard, was that they were jewelers who headed off to war, uncertain about their future, would have taken what would have been their entire working stash of gems and gold and all the stuff that they were both making new items out of, but also would have been, you know,
sales
their
items,
display,
their inventory. Yeah,
put it all in, close the, you know, dug a hole in the ground, stuck it in under the floor, and then closed the shop and went off to war. And there are any number of reasons why they wouldn't have come back, either that they wouldn't have survived the war, or very shortly after the English Civil War, the aforementioned Great Fire of London in 1666.
Right. So it seems to predate the fire. It
predates the fire. And, you know, the fire swept through London and burned everything absolutely to a cinder. It was, you know, when you read about the Great Fire of London, it's astonishing the destruction that was wrought. And one of the reasons King Charles actually offered to send help to the city in the early, because the fire lasted many days. At the very, and the way that they fought fires then was they they created a fire break by just destroying buildings on the edge of the fire so that it wouldn't jump. Yeah. But the city of London hesitated.
Because they're anti-King Charles?
Because Charles wanted to send help, and they refused his help because the idea of like royalist soldiers coming into the city of London offended them so much.
It's the equivalent of a red state turning down Medicare expansion.
Yeah, right. Right.
Even though it would save lives.
Or vaccines, even.
Sure.
So at the point that the city of London burned, there would have been nothing left in that space except this brick foundation that was subsequently built upon. And and that was what they were tearing down in 1912. So the jewels in the hoard, one of the things that was astonishing about them was that they came from around the world. The hoard had this beautiful worked jewelry, emeralds and topazes and rubies, all the stripper names. But you're talking about 1640s London. There were jewels from Brazil and Sri Lanka, India,
oh, wow.
Burma, all over the empire. Afghanistan, Persia, but also,
can you tell the provenance of these gems just by the fact that they're a type that wouldn't have been in London otherwise, or is there on the record? Can we tell by the cut that this is? Can we figure out which gem is which?
So gemology can identify.
Did you say Jumanji?
Jumanji.
If you say gemology, gemology, gemology,
gemology, gemology, gemology,
the hippos still will gemology.
But then Beetlejuice arrives. No, you can tell by spectral imaging a lot about a gem and where it came from. And you can say, oh, this is a blood diamond, whereas this is a diamond that isn't soaked in
just
blood.
The impurities in it or whatever can tell you region. And
a lot of precious gems really only come from one place and in the world. And so the difference between a Brazilian topaz and a topaz from somewhere else should be very evident in spectral imaging. But there were also a lot of cameos and other pieces of jewelry that were ancient, that were Egyptian or were from, that had.
So there was a trade in that centuries ago.
Yeah.
Wealthy people would want to wear ancient jewelry. Collect it.
Right. And things from Persia were imputed with these, kind of magical properties, not even historical, but
I guess in the 17th century, there was a wealthy merchant class that had not just disposable income, but also maybe a collection at home, a cabinet of curiosities where they would show off their knowledge and wealth and influence by having, a geographic variety of things. And that would include little items like these kind of cameos or amulets or whatever.
Yeah. And as you were in answer to your question about whether the cut of the stone gave some sense of its provenance, this was right at the turn of the right at the beginning of precise cutting of gems, so that most of the gems in the hoard were a cabochon cut, which is just, if you think about it, an ancient gem, it's just polished. It's kind of
like a little dome or something.
Yeah, you take the stone and you polish it as best you can in all directions until you have a beautiful shiny.
It's like a rock tumbler rock.
Right. Yeah. As opposed to what became, the faceted cutting of gemstones and this hoard kind of bridges that gap, although most of the stones are not faceted. But there were, most famously among the hoard was an emerald that had originally been the size of an apple that had been faceted and cut in such a way that they added the workings of a watch, a Swiss watch movement inside the emerald so that it had a lid. It had been cut so that there was a lid to it, and the lid was translucent or transparent. You could actually see the watch movement through the emerald, through the cut lid of the emerald. And then, it would have been a pocket watch, but it would have been like the size of a, what a walnut, I guess.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
It's not. But it was.
Putting mechanism in jewels.
It's I mean, this is, they're kind of some one of the kind jewels in this. But trying to figure out, I mean, it's part of the story that the Cheapside Horde tells is that the selection that would have been available at this jeweler's, this member of the Worshipful Company of Goldsmiths, or, you know, this guild. Yeah,
the WCG.
Would have, you know, how could it have encompassed such a wide, how would a shop just down on the street, you know, have this, even by 1640, have a global reach?
So could this be some unusual guy with some unusual connections, a smuggler or something, or would any corner jewelry store have had this stuff?
Well, so Stony Jack is responsible for over 12,000 objects in the Museum of London. He has populated the museums of the United Kingdom with a lot more than the Cheapside Horde.
Oh, okay.
But by trying to put the Cheapside Horde back together, there was a lot of interest in it, and again, this was a kind of dawn of museums trying to piece together what would have been a larger story. These aren't just beautiful things. Like, what are these? What do they represent? The Cheapside Horde actually went into like a safe deposit box during the Blitz and never came back out. It was kind of forgotten or lost, forgotten, not seen in public until just recently in the mid 2010s. It was
put back on display,
and it was a big event in London to be able to see all these things in there. And it was actually, you know, kind of displayed.
I'm going to look for pictures. Are these really just eye popping things even today? Or would you have to have context to be like, it's like trying to get a kid today to watch Citizen Kane. And you're like, okay, this looks a little weird now, but you have to understand.
No, they're beautiful things. But kind of an answer to your question, the way they were displayed in their most recent exhibition, there was a little theatricality to it. They put lights behind them to imitate the candlelight of Elizabethan England.
Plus the fact that they were just found in a cellar is a pretty good story.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun, and it excites our...
this stuff is beautiful.
It is beautiful. It excites our treasure hunting natures and so forth. But it was just recently that
A Carnelian squirrel pendant.
I want a
Carnelian squirrel.
Well, and I think you could probably get one at the gift shop. Actually, it's not on display right now. They're preparing a giant, you know, kind of permanent exhibition of the Cheapside Horde that should open in the next year or two.
Yeah, I've been to the Museum of London, and I don't believe this stuff was on display when I was
No,
there.
2014, it did a year out in the air, and then they decided, oh, you know what, this is... And there are still probably... lots of stuff from the Cheapside Horde that Stony Jack wasn't able to get back from the tavern owners that
it was too late.
Yeah, it kind of dispersed through. And so there's still, I think the Museum of London is still kind of has a call out, like still trying to put together, if your great-grandfather owned a tavern in Cheapside and came home with a lot of emerald lizards at one point, you know, maybe... Let us take a look at them.
I'm looking at the hinged emerald now, and it is really something else.
Yeah.
It looks like it's from Dune, or, you know, it's from an alien planet.
Yeah, it's not even, you know, in some ways, not even the most fantastic of the jeweled items.
There's just hundreds of these things. Is some of this stuff, is there stuff that didn't survive because it had components that were leather or cloth or...
Interestingly, the clay around the city of London is really good at preserving leather and, organic material because the clay kind of creates this oxygen-free environment. And so Stony Jack was legendary for pulling out Roman sandals that had been found in recent excavations. And he was running a shop where he would sell this stuff to you for a couple of shillings, but it wasn't like he everything that was in Stony Jack's shop is in the Museum of London now.
Did you see this about the pearls?
Yeah, the pearls rot away, right?
Yeah, pearls will dissolve in vinegar given time. So I assume centuries of rain leaching through limestone or whatever can't be good.
Yeah, there was enough evidence of pearls that they could, that they, and I think it might have been from the settings that they realized the pearls were from Bahrain.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So, again, adding to the international nature of the hoard.
But yeah, this says there are about almost 1,400 empty pearl settings in there.
Yeah.
So, we know there would have been 1,400 pearls.
Yeah, just it would have been great.
Don't put your pearls in a basement for 500 years.
But very recently, the Cheapside hoard has been kind of reevaluated by, and a theory promulgated by an archaeologist or, you know, a researcher by the name of Chris Lane, who teaches at Tulane. And if you look at Chris Lane...
I think that's how he got the job.
Yeah, Lane and Tulane and
Tulane only hires
double
people
lane, five
that
lanes
rhyme with the name of the university.
Chris Lane is about my age, and when you look at him, he just looks exactly like somebody who is a researcher of the Cheapside hoard and has a theory about it. And
what's,
you know,
his theory?
You kind of want to go and just grab him by the shirt and shake him and go, "How dare you be so so perfect, perfectly suited?"
That's
for
how
this.
Guidance counselors pick careers for people. They're like, this guy,
you know,
looks like an archaeologist.
He's 6'1". We could make him a CEO, or we could give him a job as an archaeologist. Well, his theory, and this is where it gets very interesting.
Finally.
Yeah, I know.
That's what I want.
In 1631, a Dutchman by the name of Gerald Polman, who had been acting as a trader in the Dutch East India Company, had and a jeweler, had in his, you know, in Indonesia or whatever, had been running a whole jewelry trading business for many years, and he was returning to Europe and, you know, pulling up stakes and leaving behind his career in Dutch East India, returning to Europe with a giant chest full of all of his collected treasures and his great wealth. And he boarded a ship called the Discovery. And he, I think very foolishly, paid, or I mean, or Chris Lane suggests very foolishly, you know, paid extra money in paying for his passage to ensure the safety of his giant gilded chest full of jewels and pearls and the and gold and the wealth of his whatever what it, half a century of rapacious jewelry dealing in Dutch East India. And on his passage from Indonesia back to Europe, he was poisoned and died on board the ship.
Like he took ill or somebody poisoned him?
Well, this Chris Lane's theory is that he was, and I think this was even the theory at the time, he was poisoned by the ship's doctor.
Ooh, a rival who wanted his stuff?
Well, it seems like his wealth was dispersed among the crew of the ship, even as he made his, you know, even as his body, I mean, I think they threw his body overboard and really, like,
so don't get on the ship and be like, you would not believe
yeah.
the kinds of gemstones I have in my safe in my cabin.
I'll give you an extra shilling if you help carry my giant chest full of gold,
which is mine and not yours.
And so the wealth of Gerald Pullman's chest was, you know, distributed among the crew of this unscrupulous Discovery ship. And when the Discovery landed, the crew kind of came ashore and all, you know, pawned their jewels. And this includes yeah. the captain and the ship's doctor. But one of the crewmen who maybe took a greater share or was more public about it, more or less discreet about it, was a carpenter's mate by the name of Christopher Adams. And Christopher Adams brought this treasure back, and he and his wife lived kind of high on the hog. And eventually they were prosecuted because the Dutch East India Company itself claimed ownership of the great wealth of their agent, Gerald Polner.
Back in the day, if you died, your employer would just try to claim your stuff.
Right. Well, or just say like how, you know, this was all.
I guess he was an agent of theirs overseas.
Yeah. And this would have represented, you know, I think he probably considered it his private collection. But at the point at which Christopher Adams and his shipmates were swinging around London selling all these emeralds for beer, the Dutch East India Company tried to intervene and sue. And in fact, Christopher Adams ended up going to jail for looting. And the wealth of the Pullman hoard was like a small fraction of it was consolidated in this, what became the Cheapside hoard. So, I think probably the great majority of it, or at least a large portion of it, was already widely dispersed among the crew and went out into the pawn shops and jewelry traders of London long before this.
Wait, so this
smaller
was,
fraction.
This was just one sailor's take? Like this might have been that carpenter's mate or whatever?
So the theory of Chris Lane is that the goldsmiths of the Worshipful Company of Goldsmiths that had their shop on Cheapside would have been working to buy up and reassembling this.
I see.
And in fact, they didn't bury it in the foundation of the building because they were headed off to fight the English Civil War, but they hid it in the basement. They buried it under the floor to hide it from the Dutch East India Company lawyers.
Because it was actually illegal contraband.
Right.
They didn't want anybody to know what they had.
At this very time, they would have been filing discovery motions to, you know, to regain control over all of these emerald watches and lizard brooches. And one of the most prominent sets of jewels in the hoard are what's called toadstones.
I've never heard of toadstone.
A toadstone was regarded even as recently as the English Civil War as a magic gem that lives inside the head of toads that protects them and by extension you from poison.
As we all know, although no one has ever found one, toads have a magic gem in their head.
Toads have magic gems in their heads called toadstones.
Couldn't you disprove this simply by dissecting a toad?
Well, yes, but toadstones may come from magic toads, which are harder to find in England.
I see. This is a rare occurrence.
And toadstones and tongue stones, which were also valuable and seen or thought of as the fossilized tongues of dragons, actually were a tongue stone was just a shark's tooth that looked like the tongue of a dragon rather than the tooth of a shark.
They had never seen a tongue of a dragon, but they had imagined it must look something like this.
And so a puka shell necklace with a shark's tooth hanging from it was not a surfer innovation. It was actually a Elizabethan era and older, like item of jewelry worn by nobility to harness the power of a dragon's tongue.
A magical protective amulet kind of a thing?
Yeah. So we think of it as a 70s surfer trope, but it actually, the shark tooth necklace goes back many centuries.
You're a scared, wealthy Elizabethan.
Mm-hmm. And the toadstone is the tooth of a prehistoric fish, the genus Lepidotes has grinding teeth that look like round stones when taken out of context.
So it's not, it actually looks like a sphere kind of, it's not polished into that shape much. The tooth is sphere-like.
Oh. And so they're kind of naturally occurring gemstones to a non-biologist who's versed in the teeth of ancient fish. They looked like perfect gemstones, and of course, naturally, you would think that they came from the head of a giant toad. Anyway.
Yeah, you would just assume. You would see it and think, well, clearly this, in the absence of another explanation, I bet this came from the head of a giant toad.
Almost any time I pick something up off the ground and can't tell you what it is, my first thought is it probably came from a toad.
Hard to disprove. And that concludes the Cheapside Hoard. Entry 210.MT0620, certificate number 7089, in the omnibus. Now, thank you for uncovering this buried treasure of all of our records of our time. Mm-hmm. Please understand that we, in our time, the most popular method of record keeping was not inscribing your podcast on giant gold cylinders, but with social media. So in our area, you could find us at Omnibus Project. I was at Ken Jennings on a variety of social media. John, you could find via his Patreon. The show, in fact, the whole project, the whole endeavor was supported by our Patreon, the generosity of our supporters and listeners, kept Omnibus going. If you are listening in an era where you have disposable income available, don't spend it on toadstones and cameos of Viscount Stafford. Instead, contribute to our ongoing attempt to catalog all of human civilization and culture by checking out the many benefits available to you at patreon.com/omnibusproject. This very entry in the Omnibus, John, was suggested by a Patreon donor by the name of Charles.
Hello, Charles. Thank you so much for giving me the challenge of telling the story of the Cheapside Hoard.
Do you think it was Charles II?
No. I think it might have been Charles. Every person named Charles is descended from Charles II.
A lot of people don't know that.
It's like the Coens. That's
right.
You
your
know,
job.
Basically, like, if you're going to name your child Charles, you have to have a prove a direct line.
There's an episode of Charles in Charge about that, I believe. Mm-hmm. The you could also send us email at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Send us physical artifacts. Send us your own toadstones and tongue stones to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. I just opened this letter we got from James in Albuquerque, who said we might enjoy an article in Ad Age, and I can't figure out if he means the front of the page or the back.
I have read Ad Age for many years, and I enjoy all their great work.
It's possible that he wants us to see this article, Shikari Richardson fronts Beats by Dre and for new Kanye West album.
Hmm. I mean, is that the one? What about the opinion on the back there?
Or the suspension of Nielsen ratings. I think it's more likely that he wanted us to see this column about the ways social scientists divide up generations. You know, the baby boomers versus...
It's very exciting talk.
You know, because the dividing lines are pretty kind of blurry and arbitrary, and yet we treat it like it's just a hallmark of how society works now is people with these birthdays act like this, whereas people with those birthdays act like this.
Yeah, you and I would consider ourselves both to be members of Generation X, but you played with He-Man dolls, and I wouldn't...
You played with Stretch Armstrong.
I wouldn't pick a He-Man doll up off a burning pile of garbage.
I actually considered He-Man to be a little gauche, because they don't post-date me by that much, but I already had enough Star Wars stuff that He-Man's just a different scale, and he's got a cartoon, and that just... That Not just seems wrong.
Uncool, right?
Uncool. So thank you for this, James, for this look at...
You know what? You know what the greatest generation gap between the two of us is? Is that you had a crush on Tiffany.
I did not have a crush on Tiffany.
You had a crush on Tiffany, and, you know...
I'm a Belinda Carlisle guy.
Oh, that's right.
The gap between us is Belinda Carlisle versus Jane Wheeler, and that has nothing to do with era.
No, that's just style.
That's 100% personality. Thank you. You can also find, if you're listening to this and you feel alone, you feel like you're the only person in your life that wants to talk about the provenance of Toadstone, look, go online. Find other like-minded listeners at the Futurelings congregations on Facebook or Reddit or there's a Discord, I think. Mm-hmm. They're fun. They'll want to entertain your thoughts about what grows inside the heads of magic toads, almost certainly.
That's right. You should actually just seek out the worshipful company of Futurelings. It's probably out there. It's the 111th guild.
If there is no such guild in your time, now's the time to start making and distributing cameos or challenge coins, which mm-hmm. I guess are the intaglio of the future. Mm-hmm. And get a little worshipful guilty. What are they? Are they worshipful of God, I assume, and not of the gold itself? What do you think they're worshipful of?
No, they're worshipful of the crown and of God. Yeah, it's all connected to, at the time, the guilds would have been very connected to the church. I should probably do an omnibus on the worshipful guilds of London.
Yeah.
There are the 12 great worshipful guilds.
Because today, if you were going to brag about yourself, or even humble brag, you would not note how worshipful you were.
No, that's a brag of a different time. Yeah, the worshipful guilds, I think the the number one worshipful guild is the Guild of, what is it? Mercers, maybe?
What does a mercer do?
The Guild of Grocers.
Oh, is a mercer just a marketplace, a market owner?
Yeah, a market owner. And then after that, grocers, and I think probably the third is like drapers, maybe? Fishmongers.
You want to do a whole omnibus on each of these? You want to have an omnibus on worshipful drapers?
I feel like the competition between the top 12 worshipful guilds is definitely an omnibus.
I looked up Mercer, and Mercers are draper adjacent.
They're like, drapers.
Well, they're dealers and whatever. I mean, obviously, you can see where the word just comes from, merchandise. But right. In practice, I think it was often fabric. It was often a Joann's, basically.
Yeah, right. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. Although omnibus is a good like barometer of our civilization. As long as omnibus survives, so too does our civilization, and vice versa. The last omnibus will herald the end of our time.
Wow.
Yeah.
No pressure. You mean because we will bring it about, or just because we won't be able to meet the next Wednesday because civilization will have ended?
Either thing. I think they're synonymous, right? If we cannot...
If we produce a sufficiently good show or bad show, we can end the world.
That's it. The whole world ends. We hope and pray that catastrophe we fear may never come until Ken and I have enriched ourselves sufficiently that we can live without omnibus. Or have exhausted all world knowledge.
It's true.
It feels like we have done that sometimes.
Then we will end the show, but society will go on. Perhaps generating new knowledge, and then we'll have to keep coming back together to do like the World Book Encyclopedia 1971 yearbook.
That's the thing. It's like the end of history. What seemed like it was going to be 1989, but it turned out more history happened.
Yeah, bad history.
If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the omnibus.